Great, that worked. Hello again. My name's Professor Jem Bendel. I'm a professor of management working on corporate responsibility and responsible investment. In the last couple of years, I've become increasingly interested in deeper questions about the monetary system. And so that's why I was fascinated to find out about the working group that Globe Ethics has on this topic and the particular focus that it has on a global reference currency. So one idea for moving beyond just simply critique and actually looking at different proposals for what we should do about crisis. And it's interesting, on the way here I was wondering, when do we stop calling a crisis? I think in August it's the fifth anniversary of the start of the real sort of implosion with the subprime mortgages. I think then in September there was a run on Northern Rock in the UK in September 2007. So when do we recognize that it might not be crisis anymore, that we should maybe recognize this as decline or transition? And in which case, transition to what and why and how to get there. So I think it's a good time to be thinking deeply and broadly about this. And we have a very international and fairly multi-sectoral panel today with people from, with people with experience within banks, people who are economists, people who are lawyers and have been at the heart of the beast in Wall Street, and also representative from small, medium-sized enterprise, the heart of the real economy that's been so damaged in the last few years by what's been going on in the financial sector. So I think we'll get a variety of perspectives. So I'm looking forward to listening to what we're going to hear. So what I'll do is I'll introduce each panelist as they make their intervention rather than at the start. So without further ado, some of you will have met Thomas Myers yesterday. He's a lawyer and it's a new term for me, a forensic accountant. And from the US, and he lectures widely on the Wall Street frauds that are at the heart of the current credit crisis. And he's been training various people in FBI and other agencies on the details of this fraud and financial crime and how to investigate it. So he has a real insider's view, which is invaluable. When we hear such terrible things going on, it's really good to actually hear from someone who's been directly involved in looking at all the documents and seeing what's really going on. So Thomas is going to tell us a little bit about the work of the working group on the global reference currency and some of his own ideas about why it's so important and what maybe could happen next and how we might be able to get involved. So Thomas, thank you.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate the introduction. Can you hear me okay? I've actually got some formal comments to make regarding the results of our exchange of information with respect to the work group. And I'm going to talk about some of the various factors that we considered in coming up with any insight that we have with respect to what to do with the financial system. And then we'll talk about alternatives possibly for implementing change. Now, during the past decade, it's clear that the United States, my country, has been like an irresponsible college freshman using a parent's credit card to go on a massive spending spree. And like this spoiled student, the U.S. consumption has been excessive, out of all proportion to existing revenues, and not sustainable over time. In the recent past, there have been two massive controversial wars and a huge Wall Street bailout, as well as unprecedented tax cuts for the wealthy elite. And they've been significantly subsidized by borrowings from the rest of the world in the form of the purchase of U.S. Treasury bonds. Indeed, as much as of the $15 trillion U.S. deficit has gone to fund dubious, arguably politically driven expenditures. Later, I'll make the case that the dollar is overvalued, resulting in a loss of U.S. trade competitiveness and concomitant evisceration of its manufacturing infrastructure, as well as the overall job demand for the middle class. In our work group, we've examined the premise that the U.S. dollar as world reserve currency may no longer be called for, and in fact may be inimical to both U.S. and global interests. It seems clear that reform is in order. Any such reform of the global reserve currency must better meet the needs of the developed and the developing countries in order to bestow the maximum benefit to all citizens of the world. In the wake of the financial crisis, such overhaul has to have as its objective an economic system that facilitates sustainable and equitable growth through an environmentally friendly regimen that promotes social responsibility and that meets squarely the challenges of global poverty, responsible use of natural resources, and the elimination of the social and economic unrest that leads to conflict. I propose that for a number of reasons, it may be unethical to purchase U.S. treasuries. This is because of the enormous moral hazard that arises with excess deficit funding that's essentially been squandered by the U.S. indiscriminately to promote various dubious agendas which will benefit neither U.S. citizens, nor global citizens at large. The prodigious sale of U.S. Treasury bonds are, of course, greatly facilitated by the U.S. dollar status as world reserve currency. Change for the benefit of both the U.S. and the global society is imperative. In other words, in our group, we determined that, or we discussed the issues that the shift from the dollar as world global currency could actually benefit the United States and the rest of the world. So it isn't necessarily detrimental to the United States in our view. From the U.S. perspective, it's clear that the unlimited ability to borrow in foreign markets has created a dependency that's neither healthy nor sustainable. Such dependencies, exemplified by low interest rates and easy money, has also created an unlimited potential for bubbles that led to the dot-com and later the subprime mortgage frenzy. Recent catastrophic examples of Wall Street structured finance abuse have been attended by insipid U.S. regulatory and Treasury Department complicity with the big banks who brought us the debacle for which they themselves and their executive management have profited in an obscene fashion. So it's our position that the Federal Reserve and some of the U.S. banking regulators really more likely represent the big banks rather than regulate them. The failure to regulate the big banks underscores the degree to which debt dysfunction characterizes the U.S. economy, has eviscerated the U.S. economic infrastructure, and threatens to turn the American dream into a nightmare. In the U.S., the regulatory agencies, as I said, represent the big banks. This is my own personal opinion. And they don't regulate them in any prudent sense of the word. Throughout my career, over the past two decades, I've provided extensive training for all of the banking regulatory agencies in the United States. In fact, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve engaged me to put together a consortium of experts to explain subprime structured finance products because so many of those securitizations, collateralized debt obligations, and so forth were finding their way into the Fed balance sheet. So we put together in Washington, D.C., a consortium for a week to basically explain to capital market specialists throughout the United States what the issues were with respect to optimizing the return on some of these structured finance products. So my own personal views come from extensive experience working with the regulators. And it's my opinion that the Federal Reserve serves as a de facto proxy for a cartel of U.S. and certain other large global banks. In other words, they're there to protect the big banks, not to regulate them. There exists a duplicitous cast of characters who have engendered the financial crisis, including out-of-control subprime mortgage originators, all-too-compliant ratings agencies, greedy investment bankers, and the complicit regulators who aided and abetted the bad actors rather than discipline them. Now, we could spend an entire day talking about the ratings agencies' roles and how they get paid by the issuers of the securities for the rating, which is a tremendous inherent conflict in and of itself. It's sad to say that the U.S. banking regulators and Treasury have been essential partners with the same investment banking community that hijacked the world economy. U.S. regulatory too-big-to-fail policies underscore how excessive borrowings from the rest of the world subsidize dysfunctional payments to Wall Street opportunists who have created epic moral hazards. The Wall Street banksters deserve stiff penalties and even criminal sanctions instead of Federal Reserve handouts, in my view. In my professional career, I've been engaged to investigate allegations of securities fraud against more than 20 major Wall Street players, including investment bankers, mortgage originators, ratings agencies, and other architects of the subprime credit debacle. Now, in that capacity, typically, I provide expert witness services in litigation. And in litigation, part of the process is you're entitled to discovery of documents from the opposing party. So in connection with some of the analyses and the investigations that my company has undertaken, we have access to information, huge databases of emails and internal documents and so on that would not be available normally to anybody else. It's only through the litigation process they get subpoenaed. And there's always, inevitably, a confidentiality agreement so that I can't talk about the particular documents that I've seen, but I can tell you that at the bottom of all of this is pervasive, patent, obvious, clear, unequivocal fraud. If we had the time, we could document firsthand how greedy Wall Street investment bankers, with the tacit approval and even assistance from the United States Treasury and the Federal Reserve, successfully gained the system to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, that may seem like a strong statement when I'm implicating the United States Treasury. But when you consider that Henry Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary of the United States at the time the financial crisis descended upon us, was formerly the CEO of Goldman Sachs, at the time when Goldman Sachs was one of the key players in developing these subprime toxic products, benefited enormously from that. He had a huge bonus just the year before he went into to become the U.S. Treasury Secretary. He was at the head of Goldman when Goldman was assisting Greece with their cross-currency swaps to help Greece keep their debt off their balance sheet. So the U.S. Treasury has been tainted for some time, at least in my view. Timothy Geithner, who's the present Treasury Secretary, is another bad actor in my view. He was president of the New York Fed at the time the New York Fed unilaterally bailed out AIG, this huge bond insurer, and caused them to make payments to all of the Wall Street insiders, including Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, and others, when it wasn't necessary. Global chaos and international economic dysfunction have been left in the wake of these actions. I think there's an unholy alliance between the United States Treasury, the Federal Reserve, and Wall Street's largest commercial and investment banks, who have stolen billions from U.S. taxpayers. Indeed, the financial havoc that's been wrought by these opportunistic global banks has metastasized throughout the entire global community, and if examined closely enough, will reveal themselves in the roots of the current European economic community dilemma. Indiscriminate misuse of public funds to bail out the banksters, alongside generous tax cuts for the U.S. wealthy elite, coupled with the use of funds borrowed from the rest of the world to undertake discretionary wars, all point to the fact that the enormous borrowing capacity of the U.S. has been squandered. Clearly, the current international monetary system, which is dependent on the U.S. dollar as reserve currency, is in need of reform. Hand in hand with this problem is the specter of out-of-control U.S. budget deficits. Socially responsible public policy would dictate that in order to pay their fair share, the U.S. wealthy elite should be taxed at reasonably progressive rates. Such a policy has been espoused by none other than Warren Buffett in his New York Times op-ed entitled, "Stop Coddling the Super Rich." However, instead of ultra-rich people in the United States paying taxes, the government borrows money from the global markets, which have been mesmerized into thinking that the U.S. Treasury bonds are a safe haven in times of economic stress. So far, this has been true. In the future, we shall see. Like a trained Pavlovian dog that's conditioned to respond by rote, world capital flees to the, quote, safety of U.S. dollar-denominated treasuries. Such a phenomenon, as illustrated poignantly by the recent downgrade of U.S. debt by Standard & Poor's, you would expect that the dollar would react in an adverse fashion, but instead it actually appreciated in value, demonstrating this, what I characterize as a Pavlovian response by the world to any type of stress, any type of unusual, traumatic world event, and capital flows into the dollar. Reminiscent of this storied fable, it may be only a matter of time before the global economy comes to the realization that the current U.S. financial system is much like an emperor with no clothes. The Federal Reserve's related policy of holding interest rates artificially low serves multinational corporations, corporate borrowers, while at the same time providing an enormous disincentive for individual savings in the United States. I mean, certificates of deposit are earned something like 50 basis points. The incredibly low Fed rate, which also begets unrealistic low mortgage, CD, and savings deposit rates, provides a significant disincentive for individual savers and amounts to an enormous hidden tax on those who save. Historically low U.S. mortgage rates provide an artificial floor for housing prices. In other words, housing prices have not adjusted down as much as they should because they're subsidized by these inordinately low interest rates. Many economists believe that the markets, not the Fed, should control these things. It should be apparent that such unrealistically low interest rates ultimately will engender future bubbles. Savers are forced inexorably into the stock market in a search for higher yield, pension funds and savers, thereby inflating stock values and playing into Wall Street's hands. In a distortion of what would otherwise be appropriate Keynesian logic, consumers are exhorted to spend as if it were a patriotic duty to run up personal debt in order to stimulate the economy. Pension funds and other assets of retirement America are encouraged to be invested in a stock market that's built on the shifting sand of inside traders, universal executive stock option compensation, which has led to an epidemic of securities fraud engendered by a short-term profit horizon and U.S. subsidized corporate profits. And it's that area, securities fraud, that I specialize in, and that's where most of my professional career has been spent. So the problem arises because so much of executive compensation with respect to these large corporations relates to stock option compensation. So there's tremendous incentive for management to manipulate earnings over the short term, thus increasing stock values so that they can cash in on their options and then move on down the road, even as the corporation they formerly headed crashes. the government policy of excluding dividends paid by corporations from taxation further constitutes an artificial stimulus that benefits Wall Street while encouraging speculation in the stock market. In my opinion, Wall Street is not Main Street. The profits of large multinational corporations do precious little to benefit middle-class job seekers. The ballyhooed trickle-down of corporate profits can more accurately be characterized as a meltdown of economic opportunity for the less privileged masses. A reserve currency is often held in significant quantities by governmental entities and typically comprises a significant portion of a country's foreign exchange reserves. The reserve currency is also generally utilized as the international pricing currency for commodities traded in the global market, including gold and oil. Since the U.S. dollar is said to have reserve currency status, the global markets have largely forgiven the United States for running higher trade deficits and tended to turn a blind eye to the economic impact of U.S. profligate spending, spending that hasn't benefited U.S. citizens generally. Reserve currency status permits the issuing country, that would be the United States, in general to purchase commodities in the world's markets at a marginally lower rate than other nations who must exchange their respective currencies for each purchase. Thus, the U.S. pays an incrementally lower transaction cost. It's called the exorbitant privilege. It was dubbed that by some Frenchman.
I can't.
Thank you. It's an exorbitant privilege. Reserve currency status also permits the United States to borrow money at a more favorable rate, since there is a guaranteed market for the U.S. dollar. And such borrowings manifest in the prodigious sale of U.S. Treasury bonds. So what happens is that developing countries, in order to engage in international trade, have to buy dollars or treasury bonds that have an inordinately low yield, and it's a tremendous misallocation of that resource for developing countries, at least in the view of our work group. U.S. spending, when U.S. spending is $3.6 trillion a year and the economy is only bringing in $2.2 trillion, the Fed's prescription has been to increase spending through printing more money. In the recent past, implemented by, among other things, quantitative easing, the printing of money has been exemplified by the U.S. Federal Reserve's sucking up some $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities of dubious quality. And it's those mortgage-backed securities that we came together in Washington to talk about how to optimize the return and what they were really worth in that consortium that I put together for the Federal Reserve. Ironically, the Fed played a major role and subsidizing the toxic mortgage-backed security bubble by engineering the artificially low interest rates that prevailed during that era and which still exist today. Certainly, U.S. reserve currency status and its attendant benefits and privileges should carry with it a serious responsibility regarding governmental, social, and corporate governance issues. But this does not appear to be the case with the purchase of U.S. Treasury bonds. Foreign buyers of U.S. Treasury bonds as creditors should be entitled to certain protections, warranties, and covenants that ensure that monies advanced are applied in a manner that supports the infrastructure of the borrower, that is, the United States. I've written a number of books on banking, and so I'm an expert on commercial lending and so forth. And when you have a large commercial loan, the borrower is required to make certain representations and warranties in the loan documents. But that's not true when countries lend the United States money. For example, China is a huge creditor lender to the United States. Nearly $3 trillion have been loaned by China. But there, we would never expect, for example, to see China say, hey, listen, we're going to give you this $3 trillion, but we don't want you to undertake any more discretionary wars. And by the way, we think you should tax your ultra-rich and make them pay their fair share, and we don't want you to any more bail out these too-big-to-fail institutions. Now, that would be preposterous for somebody to propose that, I suppose. But why? I mean, they're a lender. They're entitled to representations and warranties and certain covenants. So I'm going to yield now the floor to other speakers, but I just wanted to say I will be talking, or we will propose solutions to the current debt crisis, and we actually have examined, the work group has, the UN proposal that was made for international currency certificates to replace the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency, and we can talk more about that in detail as the discussion develops here. So thank you.
Thank you, Thomas, for a good analysis of some of the problems in the current U.S. monetary and banking system, which also then helps us think about whether we should rely on this in global trade in the way that we do. I was wondering, as you were speaking, because you would be the one to know this, how many U.S. bankers are in jail because of their role in the subprime crisis in terms of all the derivatives related to that?
Well, that's a good question, because most of these guys, they wipe their fingerprints off the documents after they sign them. They're not in jail. The United States Attorney's Office has prosecuted zero. And there was one indictment with respect to, I think, Bear Stearns early on, and they lost that case. But there isn't one individual from any of the banks related to the financial crisis that has even been indicted.
Okay, so you described a situation of regulatory capture. So how regulators are not independent, not serving the public interest when it comes to banking in the U.S. And also, to coin a phrase, I don't know if it exists, some sort of judicial capture in the sense that there's impunity here.
Institutional capture.
An institutional capture in general. Okay. Hands up those of you who think that we should continue to have the U.S. dollar as our de facto global reserve currency. It's a chance for you to make the case before we move on. Okay, so let's just clarify that then now with a lady who's written a whole book on this topic and managed to make it a bestseller. Now, that's some feat. Not everyone wants to have a whole book on this topic, but that's a sign of your good journalism as well as the critical issue this is, if we're really thinking about future solutions. So Miret Zaki works with as deputy editor of Bilan, and before that worked with Le Temps, and before that worked in Lombard Odier. So she has experience on the inside as well as analysing the sector as a whole. So let's hear from Miret. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jem. Thank you, Tom, for this excellent presentation. And my recommendations and comments will very largely share what Tom has already observed. You see, the problem with the dollar as a reference currency is that it enjoys absolutely different valuation parameters from any other currency or any other financial asset. It enjoys parameters of valuation that are beyond any rational economic thinking. They rest more on very irrational assumptions that are more sort of mythological or belong more to religious faith when you talk of the dollar. The best example is, like Tom said, when the U.S. Sovereign debt was downgraded in August 2011 by Standard & Poor's, and the whole world actually fled to find the refuge in the U.S. dollar assets and even the U.S. treasuries. Because this is the reflex we have that in our minds. The U.S. is the superpower, so their currency must be solid. It must be absolutely infallible. But the reality is that the dollar is the currency that was most printed of any currency in any other period of time. During the last 10 years, actually, since 2000, year 2000, there has been more dollars printed than during the previous 240 years of existence of the United States. We're talking here about the biggest monetary drift that history has ever known. Such amounts printed logically would lead the dollar value mathematically to zero. But as Thomas very rightly observed, the demand, the international demand for the dollar has been so great because of the monopoly the dollar enjoys on the pricing of commodities and particularly oil, that they kept printing dollars and it kept finding demand throughout the world. But this is not eternal. The point is, when a reference currency devalues, because the dollar still devalued a lot during the last year. Actually, since 1913, the date of the foundation of the Federal Reserve, it was devalued by 97%, because there's been no relation with a gold standard anymore, so the amounts have exploded. But since 2006, if you take a representative basket of very strong currencies in foreign trade, which are the yuan, the yen, the euro, and the real, the dollar lost more than 20% against those the main trade currencies since 2006. If you take the traditional dollar index, you will find that the dollar only lost 12% over the same period against a much less representative basket of Swedish krona, Swiss franc, sterling, Canadian dollar, euro, and yen. So we are still using the dollar index, although it is no longer representative, because we are resting really on myths and legends when it comes to the dollar. We prefer just to rely on faith. Now, why did I say that this is not eternal, that things are changing? First, because when you are a central bank and you have hold your reserves in dollar, because it's your reference currency, and it keeps devaluing, you cannot cover your liabilities anymore. Plus, in world trade, it also poses a problem, because when the dollar depreciates a lot and the oil is denominated in dollar, it looks like oil is actually exploding in value. Brent crude and other commodities, also gold and silver, are denominated in dollars. So they, on the graphs, on the charts, they seem to be going very much up. And what is actually happening is that the dollar is depreciating. So those commodities, which are actually, they don't change in value, since they are denominated in dollar, they appear to be inflating in price very, very much. So at a certain point, investors don't want to have their commodities listed in a currency that depreciates very quickly. So you see, there is many practical problems with a reference currency devaluing and devaluing endlessly. And what is happening now is that world trade is simply changing the rules of the game de facto. Even though the IMF, the G20, haven't really managed to put together any serious talk about the change of the reserves currency system, world trade is doing this job. Why? Because China has concluded several agreements, as you might have seen, during 2011. 2011 was a major year in the history of the dollar. The BRIC countries have concluded agreements together in order to trade without going through dollar cross rates, without trading through dollar. They're going to trade directly in their own currency. So China and Russia, ruble, yuan, China, Japan, yuan, yen, and Brazil also, and India. So you will have something like maybe 60% of world trade soon dealing together to the exclusion of the dollar. Just to have an idea, today 50% of world exports are in dollar, 30% are in euros, and the rest, most of the rest, is in yen and other currencies. But what can be expected, according to some good analysis I found, is that in 2016 already, the dollar might represent only 35 to 40% of world trade, and the euro about the same, 30-35%, and the yuan will rise to 10% and rising. So you see, we are going to move slowly towards a multi-currency world because geopolitically speaking, we are moving towards a multipolar world. I need here to say that these are not ideological, this is not ideological wishful thinking. This is a very rational analysis based on the international demand for the dollar. If you want to know which currencies are going to dominate in the future, you shouldn't base yourself on superpower plays or on even not on, on central bank reserve because they are very stable and there is a certain inertia to central bank reserve. You should only look at world trade flows. This is the key determinant. Trade flows are going to decide which is the next reference unit, and it is already becoming de facto a strong emerging economic powers currencies that are taking a central place in world trade. According to HSBC, 50% of the Chinese trade will be made in yuan by 2016, versus today only 30%, less even. Today China trades 70% with the dollar. So you see the equilibrium is changing quickly, actually, because of the consequences of the Iraqi and Afghan war that indebted the U.S. so much and forced them to print even more money, and this acceleration of money printing is making some BRIC countries decide on their own to find other ways to protect themselves and not lose too much money on their dollar exposure. Now, my conclusion is really to say that what should be reasonable today is to look at the dollar rationally, not irrationally, to look at the real situation of the U.S., a situation that is financially really disastrous, may I say, because there is no austerity plans or no plans to cut spending or even to raise the taxes. There is a real deadlock there, and we should be really careful not to find ourselves surprised by a sudden dollar crack that is a sudden day of reckoning that, as Tom said, the dollar is greatly overvalued today. So an orderly exit should be organized by international powers in a reasonable and adult way, but this is, of course, here I would say this is wishful thinking, because actually I think that the idea of a basket is wonderful. The idea of a basket makes great sense, whether it is the special drawing rights of the IMF that would be changed or improved, or the international currency certificates. It should be, of course, a basket. Because before we had the dollar hegemony, we had a multi-currency world between world wars and before the world wars. So we are going simply to return to that by the natural evolution of things and of the world balance. Now, I was going to say that maybe, unfortunately, it might, if we look really at geopolitics now, it might take a war for the U.S. to agree not to have their dollar as the reserve currency anymore, because this status, exactly like Tom said, is providing them with free funding for the enormous and failing debt of the Treasury. So this is the situation we're in today, but things are changing quickly. So I thank you for your attention, and we follow the discussion.
Thank you, Mirette. I think you answered the question I was going to ask, which is, what is the danger of a disorderly exit? So what I would like to ask is, what do you think are the dangers of an orderly exit from the dollar as the de facto reserve currency?
I think it would be the least damaging scenario, actually, is that progressively, the assets that some central banks have in dollars could be converted into at a favorable exchange rate that the U.S. should agree to provide. Those assets in dollars should be converted into a unit that is based on a basket of strong currencies. Because if they keep so many dollar assets, really this is going to put them at a very high risk. Now, would the U.S. agree to help them convert their failing dollar portfolios into this more secure and diversified basket of currencies? This is really a political issue, and sometimes countries find other ways to deal with situations, but theoretically they should have some restructuring experts at work that would help them and central banks, get rid of some of their dollar holdings.
Thank you. Do you see then that if this orderly exit occurred or disorderly exit occurred, that there would be significant implications for globalization as a whole, perhaps significant implications for agencies here in Geneva? If we think about what deficit spending can mean in terms of the projection of U.S. power, not only militarily, but also through supporting aid agencies and the like. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what it might mean for global politics, global humanitarian work and the like. Is it going to be an all positive future from this transition you're describing?
Now, the consequences of a disorderly exit would be so multiple and so complex, they're very difficult to predict. For one thing, I think commodities markets would be really put upside down, because there would be no pricing anymore. You remember the food riots we've seen everywhere in the world, because there was so much speculation on commodities prices, and it was completely out of hand, and the UNCTAD tried to denounce this trend a little, and people just couldn't buy their bread or their food anymore at reasonable prices. These kinds of inflation are really much related to currency wars and problems and instability. So we would see this problem in world food and commodities prices. The aid that the U.S. was providing to humanitarian agencies, I'm not too sure. I should not to give my real opinion about what USAID is doing in Afghanistan, for example, because I'm very critical of their role and believe that there's very little aid there, and lots of exploitation, actually. So on aid, I prefer to say that the world is not going to suffer too much. I think that the contribution of the U.S. to multilateralism in general, to international organization, has been all but weak in the last decades, that they've been much more focusing on bilateral agreements and unfortunately on war efforts as well. So it is really financial markets, private investors, commodities markets. The dollar is the main investing currency. This is the main thing. All dollar holdings everywhere in the world will suffer. African countries will suffer a lot because they use enormously the dollar. Even countries like Zimbabwe have the dollar as their main currency because the Zimbabwean dollar collapsed recently. So, the consequence will be so multiple that I think we would have really a very, very grave crisis. And the crisis will come through the crack in the sovereign bonds of the U.S., because these are going to be affected by the dollar valuation. And if we have this, we have to go through a major financial crisis before the world resets itself and depends less on U.S. the dollar-based financial markets, because they've taken an enormous center stage in every trade and in every transaction we have throughout the planet.
Thank you. Thank you. Just another check-in with you guys. Then, after Miret's presentation, I'd like to see who here thinks that if we convened in 5 years' time, 5 years from now, Who thinks that the dollar will still be the dominant global reserve currency? Just raise your hand. I won't pick on you to explain. So we have a few people who still believe that it won't be as... I think you mentioned the 2016 date.
Yep.
So that there will be a bit of inertia there.
You know, Jem, I think that if we were outside of this room in the environment of Swiss banks, where I am often and I discuss often with them, it's 99% of people who believe the dollar will remain the reserve currency. And they believe blindly in this. So.
Yes.
The bets are open.
So you're a very enlightened group.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
And those who put up your hands, I'll ask
less
you to feedback in a minute, but I want to hear from our other panelists. Who here is worried about the implications of a potential transition? If so, just sort of put your hands up. Yeah, so there's some worry here as well. Okay, so I'm getting a sense of things. So that is also an invitation for us to get better informed and get engaged and actually think about transition and a positive transition. Okay, good. So I would also now like to call on our panelists from China. Chung Zhang, is that how I pronounce your name correctly?
Correct.
Great, thank you. Chung works in finance and in specifically in relation to currencies and bond markets. Used to work here in Geneva, and you're based where now?
Both in China and Europe.
Okay, so gets the word from China and the word from Europe on a constant basis. So given your work in this field and what you've heard just now, it would be great to get your reflections.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for very clear analysis. And Tom, I think I would like to talk a little bit about the Chinese current position regarding U.S. dollars as a reserve currency. I think to better understand Chinese positions, we'd better go back about a couple of decades ago. I think when China, 30 years ago, joined the international or the Western economic and the financial orders, China did not have choice but to accept, you know, the Western-dominated financial order, including the supremacy of U.S. dollars as a reserve currencies. So at the end of 1990s, China was, like most of Asian countries, were forced to build up its foreign exchange reserve. They're mainly for two reasons. On one hand, you know, the financial crisis, the Asian financial crisis, taught a tough lesson to all Asian countries. So they cannot rely on cheap foreign capitals to finance their internal consumptions and investments. And they may create huge liquidity problems if they don't have a foreign exchange reserve. So from that moment on, most of the Asian countries, including China, start to build up their foreign exchange reserves. So on the other hand, China, like most of the Asian countries, they have an export-leading growth model, which means they export more, and they have a huge, they have in general have a trade surplus. So this model was very successful. From the end of 1990s, China became the world factory, and most of the multinationals, they had their manufacturing sites set up in China to take advantage of cheap labor, energy, tax preferential rates. So all those multinationals export from China to the Western markets, which helps China to, again, build up its foreign exchange reserves. So today, I think we're talking about 3.2 trillion of U.S. dollars of foreign exchange reserves. So with this financial crisis, under the financial crisis context, it's very helpful to have such amount of money, But at the same time, it's also a huge problem to manage. So I think Mirette and Tom has mentioned before, so China is really worried about losing some of its value of foreign exchange reserves. So I think a paper published by Chinese government of central bank in 2009, he was clearly promoting a new international reserve currency system by put emphasis or give more importance to the special joint rights of MF. So the recent injection, I think it occurs last week, the recent injection of capital from China of around $50 billion into MF confirmed the direction had been pointed out by Chinese government, Chinese governor of central banks. At the same time, in reality, what's China's, what's the real Chinese policy regarding U.S. dollars as a reserve currencies? So China has been adopted three-step strategies. So the first steps are very well described by Mirette. So China is promoting its own currency as a trade currency, which means that through theory of agreements of currency swaps within BRIC countries, India, Brazil, Russia, and with other countries, developing countries such as Japan, and they're trying to promote the RMB, the Chinese currencies, as a trade settlement currencies. So it has been quite successful for the last three to five years. So 30% of the Chinese trade has been settled in RMB. So the next step of the Chinese Monetary Authority of Chinese governments is to promote RMB as investment currencies. So it occurs with the birth of dim sum bonds in Hong Kong. So actually, today China has one currency, but around two systems, which means that you have the onshore, what we call CNY currencies, which is close to most of the foreign investors. Then we have, on the other hand, in Hong Kong, RMB-denominated financial markets, called CNH. So the exchange rate of those two systems are not the same. So the exchange rate of CNY is heavily regulated by Chinese government, and the exchange rate of the CNH is subject to the law of supply and demand, which means the markets determine the exchange rates of the CNH markets. I think the dim sum bonds markets has been launched in the middle of 2010. So within 2 years, the market reached a size of around, probably at the end of this year, $100 billion. So it's far from far behind the size of the U.S. Bonds markets. But the appetite of international investors for Chinese currency is so huge that most of the Chinese companies, and including Western companies, they start to filing their request to issue CNH-denominated bonds in Hong Kong. So today, China, we can see that Chinese currencies is becoming investment currencies, but it's still far from being reserve currencies. So I think the only example that we can see that China is becoming, is on the way of becoming reserve currencies, its currency swap agreement with Japan. So Japan will probably invest 1% of its total currency, foreign exchange reserves into Chinese interbank markets to buy Chinese central bank bills, police bank bonds, or commercial bonds. So this is probably the first time that the Chinese government opened its interbank markets to foreign investors. So to answer the question is that if China could be the next reserve currencies, well, it's really still, China is still at the early stage. It may take 5 or 10 years to really build up its reputation, reform its bonds markets, and have the Chinese currencies fully convertible, including CNH and CNY. So China is doing all these steps gradually, as China has been done for the last 30 years. So at this stage, I think China is still far behind. The Chinese currency is far behind U.S. dollars and euros, and maybe in next decades that we surely see China, as a major currency in the future, but in the short term, I think China will still China still have to live with dominance of the US dollar as a reserve currencies. Thank you.